Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today we're going to talk about stem cell research. Really an amazing thing happened in the House of Representatives yesterday. For the first time in the 4.5 years of the Bush presidency, the House of Representatives decided to take a vote on a bill that the president did not support. As I said, it has never happened before in the Bush presidency, and the reason it happened is because some House moderates had to make a deal with leadership in order to agree to Bush's budget. Prior to this time, the House leaders, Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert, have said that unless a bill is supported by the president and a majority of Republicans, they won't even let it have an up or down vote in the House of Representatives. They want, even if, by the way, the bill has majority support. Well, this bill over stem cell research changed it all. It's a bill by Congresswoman Diana DeGette of Colorado and Congressman Mike Castle of Delaware, and it's a bill to provide government research, government funding, I should say, for stem cell research, and specifically for embryonic stem cell research. This has caused quite a debate across the country. As I said, the president opposes the bill, and the question is, are we destroying lives in the terms of embryos in order to help solve medical problems? Or on the other hand, are we saying that in some cases that we have to let a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old child die just to save a clump of cells? Well, to help answer these questions, I have two guests, and we're going to go 15 minutes of one and 15 minutes of the other. The first guest is Ross Frommer. He's an associate dean at Columbia University Medical Center, and he's on the board of directors of the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research. Then my second guest will be Richard Dorflinger. He's the deputy director of the Secretariat for Pro-Life Activities at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And we'll, like I said, this is a debate. We'll listen to one side for 15 minutes, then the other side, and back and forth. But you, as always, are always welcome to join the debate. You just pick up the phone and dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the weblog at radioinsidescoop.com. First of all, let me welcome Ross Frommer. Professor Frommer, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, thanks, Mike, and it's just Ross is fine. I'm actually not a professor here at Columbia.
Okay, you're an associate dean.
That is correct.
All right, and the name is Mark, so we both messed up there.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. We'll move right along. Tell me this. How did you first become involved in the issue of stem cell research?
Well, this has always been an important issue for researchers here at Columbia and for my boss, Dean Gerald Fishback, here at Columbia. And I've been here working here at Columbia for about 4 years, and it's really an issue that I picked up once I got here.
Why is it an important issue at Columbia?
Well, because we're a research institution, and part of our mission is to do research, is to discover more about the human condition and ways to fight disease and to improve the human condition.
And how does stem cell research help you fight disease?
Well, I mean, the number of researchers here see stem cell research, both embryonic as an adult, as a way of developing cures and treatments for some of the most debilitating diseases that affect over 100 million Americans: Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, diabetes. The list goes on. Plus, it can also be a great research tool because it can lead to a much greater understanding of how these disease models work.
Tell me this. How do stem cells in particular help solve some of these diseases, help cure perhaps or treat some of these diseases in ways that other treatments don't work? And also, if you could specify the difference between embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells and how they work in the treatment.
Well, sure, Mark. The beauty of a stem cell is it has the ability to become a different type of cell. That, in effect, you can take a stem cell and make it into a dopamine cell or a pancreatic islet cell. And theoretically, and it is still theory at this point, but it's really moving forward, use those cells to repair damaged cells in a patient. So if the person has Parkinson's and their dopamine neurons aren't functioning properly, you could insert new dopamine neurons to treat the Parkinson's. The difference between adult and embryonic, and you know, we're still learning more about all these fields, is that embryonic stem cells are what they call pluripotent, is that they have the ability to become any different type of cell that you could imagine. As long as scientists can figure out what signals they need to send to the cell, the cell can become, can differentiate and become the type of cell you need. Adult stem cells are thought, the common knowledge is at this point, they're really only multipotent, which means although they have potential to become different types of cells and certainly to become new forms of themselves, their ability to become other types of cells is limited.
And that would be presumably because an embryonic stem cell is part of the first clump of cells that it starts to become a human being and therefore has to differentiate itself to be hearts and lung and pancreas and arms and feet, whereas adult stem cells don't serve that same purpose. Is that fair?
Well, no, it's that adult cells, if you will, have already taken on a mission.
Part of the bone or part of the heart.
Right. So taking those cells and deprogramming them from what they were designed to do and reprogramming them into something else is different than taking an embryonic stem cell, which at this point has no specific function, and programming it to what the doctor wants it to do.
Help me out here. What is a stem cell? When you say stem, the only stem I know is from a flower. Precisely, what is a stem cell?
Well, a stem cell is a type of cell that has these specific qualities, the ability to differentiate and the ability to reproduce itself. And I guess that's where the name stem cell comes from.
Okay. Now, of course, the controversy over stem cells is particularly over embryonic stem cells. I don't think there's much of a controversy over adult stem cells, though.
Certainly no ethical controversy over adult stem cells. That is correct.
Right. And the ethical controversy is that these embryos are fertilized eggs. They have the capacity, if implanted in a woman, to become a human life, and that you shouldn't be destroying one human life to save another. How do you answer that charge?
Well, I would argue that, you know, in vitro fertilization clinics, there are approximately 400,000 stored embryos today.
400,000?
400,000.
Okay.
An overwhelming majority of them will never become a baby.
What happens to them?
Well, that's the point. Legally today, they can be discarded.
Are they discarded?
What?
Are they discarded?
Many of them are, yes. It is really up to the donor, to the couple who gives them, what they want to do. A woman has a retrieval. She has the legs implanted. Hopefully the procedure is successful and they're able to create to have a child. But there are extra eggs. There are eggs that they don't use. It is really up to the couple what to decide what they want to do with them.
Men will keep them
frozen for possible use later. But you can donate them for research. You can give them to another family, so another family could have the opportunity to have a child. But I want to stress this. Today, it is perfectly legal and done quite often is to just simply discard them.
And let me ask you this. In vitro fertilization, why is it that so many extra fertilized eggs are created, more than the one or that usually a couple wants one child at a time? Why create 10, 12 eggs?
I'm not an expert on this issue, but okay. From what I understand, the idea is that the retrieval process while it's done quite often, is not easy. It is, in effect, for the woman having her eggs extracted, the equivalent to surgery. So you certainly do not want the woman to go through that process any more frequently than she needs to. And implantation is not always successful. Sometimes it'll take 2 or 3 tries. So you don't want to have to put the patient, through the retrieval process any more often than you need to.
Ross, let me ask you this. When you use cells for stem cells, how old, if you will, is the embryo? How many days from fertilization are we talking about? Are we talking about a day, a week, a month, 2 months?
From the time the division process begins, several days at most.
Several days at most. So at the time you extract the stem cells, you have a clump of what, 10, 20, 50 cells?
You're talking about probably about 200 cells would be my guess.
200 cells. And at that time, there's no heart function or lung function
In fact, there's not even any nerve function. It is literally, the best way to describe it is a tiny little ping pong ball. And I mean tiny. It's about the size of a pen tip.
But it doesn't have the nerve function of, say, an ant or a fly.
Oh God, absolutely not. Absolutely
anything
not.
Like that. Okay. One of the things that we have here on the weblog is a number of people write in and ask questions. And my first question comes from Jason. He says he's 16 years old. And he thinks that this is all about money. He says that this research is taking place because new medicines make new money, and that's why people are supporting it. How do you address that, Charles?
Well, I can only speak for Columbia at this point.
Okay.
We are a research institution. And trying to better understand the human condition, trying to improve the human condition in terms of biomedical research is what we do. And we do that whether we're funded by the government, whether funded by private sources. We are a nonprofit. That is part of our mission. We are a nonprofit. The university, while it may receive some patent revenues for this, all of that will be reinvested in the university, in the research mission.
Now, are you making any money? Do you make any more money if you do stem cell research versus another kind of research? Are you doing this because you believe in the cause?
We do this because we want to expand knowledge. We want to create knowledge about biomedical research.
Okay, let me go to the phone lines. I've got a caller hanging on. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Ross Frommer. Caller, are you there?
Yeah, this is Alice.
Hello, Alice.
Humboldt County.
How are you? Do you have a question for our guest?
Well, there is a kind of religious craziness that has been fighting progress and science forever. Remember when lightning rods were interfering with the will of God?
I don't, but you probably do. That's
well,
a big before my time.
Right. Ben Franklin, I believe, in the 1750s,
right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, was criticized by the
mm-hmm.
Congregationalist Church, although I could be wrong on this denomination, because by inventing the lightning rod, he was frustrating the will of God to strike down sinners.
Alice, yeah. What's your view? You support stem cell research. Alice? Do you support government-funded stem cell research?
Yes, I sure do. I'm a nurse, a retired nurse.
And that's because... why do you support it? Because it could...
It could do so much good, and all it is just destroyed afterwards, so why not use it?
Okay.
That's stated very well.
Makes sense to me. Do you have a question for our guest, or is that it?
Okay.
Is that all? All right. Well, thank you very much for calling in, Alice. I do appreciate it. Let me ask you one more question, Ross, and then we have to go to a break, and I got to hear from the other side. But
sure.
My question is, since this is an issue that some believe is ethically fraught, that there are difficulties here, should you destroy a fertilized embryo in order to save other lives, why not just have private research funding? Why do you need government research funding for this?
Well, you have to understand that we have set up in this country the National Institutes of Health, NIH, by far the world's greatest biomedical research organization there is. The NIH funds and supports the best science in the world. And it supports science under government regulation, under government scrutiny. And it really does provide the best science. So if we're going to do this work, let's do it under the optimum conditions. Frankly, NIH funds about 70% of the basic research in this country. So if it's not NIH funded, a lot of it will not get done because just the resources will not be out there.
So that's true for other issues of medical research. As the government provides 70% of issues to fight heart disease, cancer.
For basic research, which is sort of gaining the general understanding of the condition. For applied research, there is much more private money. For basic research, I believe the figure is about 70%.
Let me ask you one more question before we go to break and we hear from Richard Dorflinger. Since you've said that you've given the theoretical reason why you believe that embryonic stem cells have more promise than adult stem cells, but why not try adult stem cells and then if it doesn't work, then move on to embryonic stem cells?
You know, don't you want to fight disease with both hands rather than one hand tied behind your back? You know, look, neither you nor I nor Mr. Dorflinger nor the most brilliant biologist out there knows which type of stem cell is going to cure which disease. Why not proceed on both fronts? Why not give scientists all the tools they need to fight disease and to improve the human condition?
Okay, why not pursue it on all fronts? Well, we have a guest who simply disagrees with that. We're going to find out why. His name is Richard Dorflinger. He is the Deputy Director of the Secretary for Pro-Life Activities of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Why not fight with both hands indeed? We will hear from Richard Dorflinger, and we'll hear from you at 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can comment on the weblog at RadioInsideScoop.com right after these messages.
Oh, If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to four real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? Ha, ha, ha. She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital that the government doesn't want you to know. Yesterday, the House of Representatives passed a bill to do more government-funded stem cell research than the president wanted. He has threatened to veto the bill. Well, what's the problem with stem cell research? Our first guest in the first 15 minutes was Ross Frommer. He's an associate dean at Columbia University Medical Center, and he talks about the promise that stem cells hold for curing all manner of diseases. We're going to hear back from Ross in about 15 minutes. But now I want to hear from an opponent of this bill, an opponent of government-funded stem cell research. His name is Richard Dorflinger. He's the deputy director of the Secretariat for Pro-Life Activities at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Richard Dorflinger, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, you heard what Ross Frommer had to say about the promise of stem cells to cure all these diseases. What's wrong with using them for that purpose?
Well, actually, I support stem cell research, except for the small percentage of stem cell research that requires killing live members of the human species for their stem cells. The bill that passed overwhelmingly yesterday was a bill to promote treatment and research from adult bone marrow stem cells and umbilical cord blood stem cells, and we strongly supported that. And that's the area of research that is now successfully treating patients, an estimated 30,000 patients with dozens of different diseases, and we think is going to prove extremely promising for the diseases that Mr. Frommer was talking about. The objection we have to embryonic stem cell research is simply the fact that the way you get those stem cells is to destroy a living human embryo, which we certainly feel is a a person with a right to live, but that even government advisory panels like President Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Commission said that the early embryo is a developing form of human life that deserves respect. So the range of opinions on the status of the embryo, it's not either this is a full-fledged person or nothing, but even people that don't share my view about this being a person would certainly say there's a moral problem here. There's a burden of proof to overcome. We should be bending over backwards not to destroy these earliest forms of human life if we can do things other ways. And in fact, we can do these things in other ways.
Okay, let me stop you there and just break down a lot of what you said. First of all, you are right that there were two bills passed yesterday. I should have mentioned that in the House of Representatives. The first bill passed 430-1, and it was to allow stem cell research from umbilical cords and I believe also adult stem cells, which, as the other guest, Ross Frommer, agreed, was not controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there was the second bill, the one that I was discussing, over embryonic stem cells. Now, from what I've read, though, Mr. Dorflinger, the umbilical stem cells, and I'm no scientist, but have been used pretty much only for blood diseases, and they've been successful in that. But the scientists that I've read about seem to think that that's really their sole purpose right now, that they do well with blood diseases, but they don't help with non-blood diseases.
Yeah, that's being disproved. As a matter of fact, last week, the New England Journal of Medicine reported on trials in which umbilical cord blood stem cells were used to cure, I want to say cure because it worked if you got the treatment to the infants before the symptoms began showing up. This is a rare genetic disease called infantile Krebs disease. It's a neurological condition. It leads to neurological degeneration and death. And most of the children treated with the cord blood are at normal levels of cognitive development and are very healthy children 3 years after the treatment. A year ago, the New England Journal of Medicine had very promising results on use of cord blood to treat another neurological disease called Hurler's syndrome. And in the animal trials, which can be important, they're not definitive, but then embryonic stem cells have never been used in anything but animal trials. But in animal trials, umbilical cord blood is showing great promise in treating animals with symptoms of Parkinson's, ALS, and other conditions that go way beyond the bloodstream. So there are some studies indicating that these cells can be as versatile as embryonic stem cells. Others disagree, but it's certainly an extremely promising area that may save many lives in the future.
Well, let me ask you this. If the sources disagree, then, I mean, I think we can move on to the moral question.
Mm-hmm.
All of us, I certainly do, I know Ross Frommer does, apparently 430 members of Congress, agree that these umbilical cords, adult stem cell research, that should continue and do whatever it can. But since we don't know the promise of embryonic stem cell research, and since certainly I don't believe you can rule out that stem cell research could be used in a distinct and unique way to save a life of not an embryo, but a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 35-year-old, doesn't that 35-year-old or 6-year-old or 10-year-old, don't their lives matter more than cells that, at least in vitro fertilization clinics, may be discarded anyway?
I guess, well, now you've raised a number of things I'm going to have to unpack.
Okay, fair enough.
Because the 400,000 embryos was a myth, too. But let me relate first the first part.
Okay.
I think that's right. No one can be sure. I think it's very unlikely, and I think the evidence has been mounting against safe and reliable use of embryonic stem cells in humans, but I can't exclude the possibility. But also scientific research is guided by ethical restraint, particularly when we're treating fellow members of the human species. There are some societies that forgot that, and that's why we ended up with the Nuremberg trials, and we're still living down some of our abuses in that area in terms of forced sterilizations in Virginia and elsewhere, and the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, and the experiment where retarded children in the Willowbrook home were infected with hepatitis deliberately for the great promise of research and the fact that it was going to save lives. The end doesn't justify the means in these cases. We actually asked about 1,000 Americans earlier this month exactly the question that was raised on the program earlier. you have these stem cells that can be obtained by destroying embryos. There are other stem cells that could be obtained from adults and placentas and umbilical cords that don't require doing that. And scientists disagree on which source may end up being the most successful in treating diseases. How would you, we asked these thousand Americans, how would you prefer your tax dollars to be used this year for stem cell research? And we gave them two options. Either support all methods, including those that require destroying embryos, to see which will be most successful. And the other option was to support research using adult stem cells and other alternatives to see if there's no need to destroy human embryos for research. This is exactly the way you raised the question earlier.
Yeah.
22% said fund it all, and 60% said just fund the stuff that doesn't destroy embryos to see if we don't need to go there.
I guess part of my problem with popular opinion polls on this kind of stuff is that I don't think the ordinary American, and I include myself, by the way, in that category, understands enough of the science to understand what really could be the differences and all this kind of thing. And so, you know, I guess I would ask a poll, and I suspect I would get very different results if I asked this poll, and it said, your 14-year-old child has Parkinson's disease. Embryonic stem cell research may provide a cure that adult stem cells doesn't do. Would you support destruction of a clump of cells that, you know, has no brains and so forth? Would you support attempting that in order to save your child? I suspect you'd get more than 90% saying yes.
I don't think you get 90%. You might get quite a few, but in order to ask the question fairly, you would have to inform them some more, and you would have to say, well, what has been done in humans with Parkinson's with stem cells? And you'd have to admit that while they're still doing rats with embryonic stem cells, and the last major Parkinson's trial using embryonic stem cells had a disturbing amount of tumor formation that killed 20% of the rats, you have at least the first clinical trial in Parkinson's using the patient's own adult stem cells that gave him 85% reversal of his symptoms for the last 5 years, and they're looking for money to do some broader trials. One of the tragedies of this situation is that there are a lot of adult stem cell and other cell therapy options that look extremely promising. There's nothing keeping them from moving forward except lack of money in juvenile diabetes and Parkinson's and spinal cord injury, and the money has been sucked out of those options to some extent by what I think is the exaggerated campaign for funding embryonic stem cells.
Okay, but we can all agree that there should be more money for juvenile diabetes and the
of
other
causes
that you mentioned.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, and we only have, we'll ask you one more question, and then we're going to take a commercial break and get back to Ross Frommer. But it's interesting to me that the examples you gave, the Tuskegee experiment, the Nazi experiments, were all experiments on, you know, live, sentient human beings. Is it essential to your argument to say that the 200 cells a few days after fertilization are equivalent in human dignity to a 6-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 25-year-old?
I do believe that, because I think human dignity is inherent worth, and it can't depend on how old or young or what abilities you have. If it's inherent, then it's inherent in simply being a member of the human family. But I don't think it's essential to the argument, because there are a great many who don't hold that full view of equal human dignity that I do, but still say, you know, you have a great burden of proof to overcome to show that this is going to achieve goals that simply cannot be achieved in any other way for the good of mankind, to override this moral norm against directly taking a life of any stage.
And one last question. I know that George Bush originally agreed that certain lines of stem cells that had already been developed from pre-existing embryos could be used. He disagrees with the further lines provided by the DeGette-Castle bill. What was your view on George Bush's original stem cell research view, or is that also not right in your view?
Well, we disagreed with that compromise because you're still rewarding basically the people who have destroyed embryos for these cells, and you are holding out the promise of developing this research to the point where you may fund more of it down the road, which is where we are now. I mean, we saw this coming when the president issued his compromise, saying they're just going to want more and more as this goes down the field. I think the things that have been said about the existing cell lines are inaccurate, though, because people talk about only 22 now in existence. There are actually quite a few samples still in frozen storage that are also eligible because they were obtained from the embryos before the date of this policy as well. They've been kept in reserve for when they're needed, which turned out to be a good idea because the current cell lines, including the new ones that Castle DeJet wants to fund, are mostly contaminated with animal feeder cells, which would make them ineligible for some purposes, whereas the cells that are eligible for funding under the Bush policy were kept in the freezers and not cultured in any of those animal cells, can be brought out at any time and used when the current lines run out. So it's not as though the supply from his policy has run out. They have some in the wings that haven't been taken out and turned into active cell lines yet.
Okay, I have to interrupt you because we have to go to commercial break. Richard Dorflinger raised some good points, but my other guest, Ross Frommer, disagrees, and we will hear from him right after the commercial break. If you want to call in and have your views heard or ask a question of either of our distinguished guests, it's easy to do. Just pick up the phone and dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can comment on the weblog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back.
Anna Briggs, now 94 years young, the ethical treatment of animals has been her life's work. Anna Briggs feels that each dog at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center in Charlestown, West Virginia, from scruffy mutt to sleek purebred, deserves a loving home. All have been spayed or neutered and current with their shots and vaccinations. Plus, the majority of dogs have completed basic obedience training. You can find photos and bios of the dogs at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center website, www.baacs.org. That's baacs.org. You'll be doing something very nice for the pet you adopt, and it doesn't take long for you to discover how much these pets will help you and add to your quality of life. The Briggs Animal Adoption Center is an affiliate of the National Humane Education Society. For more information, call 304-724-6558 or visit their website, www.baacs.org.
Magellan? No.
Well, who knows what Magellan did?
Sail around the world.
Right. Now.
Sometimes, a child who doesn't seem interested is really a child with a speech or hearing problem.
Blackbeard? Who said Blackbeard? And what did Blackbeard do? He was a pirate.
Time and again, it's been shown that a young student's ability to read and learn begins with speech and language and hearing skills.
Jamie? Are you with us? Who can tell us?
He wanted to go to India.
Many communication disorders can be detected early and corrected, so learning and literacy skills can develop normally. Make sure your child has the speech, language, and hearing abilities to keep up in class. For more information, visit ASHA.org, a public service message from the American Speech, Language, Hearing Association and this station.
For a new route to
Asia!
Good. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And we're talking about stem cell research. Specifically, there's a bill that just passed yesterday in the House of Representatives. It's sponsored by Congresswoman Diana DeJet of Colorado and Mike Castle of Delaware that would provide government funding for embryonic stem cell research. It's the first bill passed by the House of Representatives that George Bush has threatened to veto. My guests are Ross Frommer. He's an associate dean at Columbia University Medical Center, and he is on the board of directors of the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research. He supports government funding of stem cell research. And Richard Dorflinger from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, that's against it. Now, we're taking turns here. We've just heard from Richard Dorflinger, and I'm going to take it back to Ross Frommer. And Ross, You know, one of the questions I asked Richard Dorflinger was, is it essential to his position that there's a difference, that there was the same human dignity between an embryo that's 200 cells old, a few days old, and someone who's 6 or 10 or 25 years old? And he said that while he believed that, it wasn't essential to his argument. Let me ask you the same question in reverse. Is it essential to your argument that a 15-year-old is more valuable, more living, more of a human being than 200 cells in an embryo?
Well, I guess in one sense I do agree with Mr. Dorflinger in that these embryos certainly deserve respect. But since a very large percentage of them are going to be discarded anyway, why shouldn't we use this material to help understand the human body, to further science, and to possibly lead to cures and treatments for such debilitating diseases? You know, Mr. Dorflinger talked about the burden of proof, and I look at it this the other way is, you know, tell a patient suffering from Parkinson's disease, from ALS, from diabetes, why isn't it that you are doing, why aren't you doing everything you can to alleviate that condition?
And I assume there are very few patients that would say, don't treat the condition with embryonic stem cells.
Well, again, you'd have to talk to the patients about that, but there are over 90 groups who are part of the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research, and you know, many of them are patient groups who advocate on behalf of the needs and the wishes of patients.
Okay, but Richard Dorflinger says, look, I mean, there are have to be limits to medical experiments. You don't have to go to the Nazi death camps. Here in the United States, there is the infamous Tuskegee Institute study back, I'm trying to remember when it was. I think it was the 30s. In any case, I know that they actually put syphilis unknowingly in American blacks to see how the body would react. I mean, pretty vicious stuff. There have to be limits, don't there?
Well, certainly, H.R. 10 sets up ethical guidelines under which embryonic stem cell research can take place, and that's very clear in the bill.
What are those guidelines?
Well, for instance, the lines must be created with donor consent. You simply can't take someone's eggs and use them to create stem cell lines without their permission. There are time, so it's informed consent. Things about having to do with lack of financial incentive. So very, very strict ethical guidelines on how this research can proceed. And let me just say one thing about this, the Tuskegee and unfortunately the Nazi reference which was made.
Go ahead.
I find this just completely, I must tell you, absurd. I mean, the fact is, whatever you agree with it, whatever you think of the stem cell research, the folks involved in Nazi experiments were not there for the purpose of saving lives. They were there for the purpose of inflicting cruel and unusual punishment on prisoners who did not consent to those experiments. Likewise, the people involved in Tuskegee. Every person involved in embryonic stem cell research is doing it for the benefit of the patient. And it's also all being done with informed consent.
Of course, the embryo doesn't have informed consent.
But the embryos, the donors, must consent.
So, in essence, it goes back to the same dispute over abortion. The question is whether an embryo, a fertilized egg, belongs to its mother or whether it is its own self-independent human being even before it's capable of independent thought.
Well, I'd like to try to keep this separate from the abortion. I do not believe this is about abortion.
Okay.
I believe this is about medical research and finding treatments and cures and allowing science to go forward.
Let me ask you this. George Bush originally agreed with a compromise proposal, one actually that Richard Dorflinger rejected, but his original proposal was to take existing stem cell lines and to use those for research, but to not to go further as the Daggett Castle bill does. Do you think that the original compromise was sufficient, and if not, why not?
Certainly now we don't. I think 4 years ago, those of us in the advocacy community, while we were disappointed that he placed limits on funding of stem cell research, we were certainly willing to work with the administration to try to make the policy work. I think, you know, it's now 4 years later. We've given it a good look, and I don't think it is working. You know, he said there were 78 lines out there. Well, the fact is, right now on the NIH website, there are only 22 available, and I don't know where Mr. Dorflinger gets his information, but from what I understand, it's only going to be anywhere, you know, from 1, 2 to 3 more lines that will ever become available for use by scientists.
Let me ask you this. Do we know that embryonic stem cells have thus far done any cure of diseases?
Well, cures of diseases, no. But as,
treatments,
but let me just point out a couple of things.
Go ahead.
First of all, they have been used quite a bit in animal experimentation. But it's important to understand the field of embryonic stem cell research is only 7 years old. In 1998, Dr. Jamie Thompson at the University of Wisconsin was the first person to successfully derive human embryonic stem cells. Of course, you know, there have been no cures that have come out from embryonic stem cell. The field of science is only 7 years old. No field of science creates cures in that short a time.
So at the end of the day, we have ethical guidelines. You said, for example, that the donors have to agree. We know that.
Yep.
What other things? I mean, for example, are these embryos less likely to be discarded than, say, the embryos of in vitro fertilization? I mean, what kind of guidelines are there? For example, I have a woman on my blog, Vicky, who talks about embryo adoption, that actually there are people that may want to adopt these embryos and women perhaps who want to make them into human beings. Does that preclude that kind of thing?
Absolutely not. Embryo adoption... wonderful. I think it's great that families who are unable to have children now are able to have children because of in vitro fertilization, because of this embryo adoption. But let's understand the figures here. As far as I know, Christian Nightlife Adoption Services, and I may be getting that name slightly wrong, there have been about 100 babies born through this procedure.
Through embryo adoption?
Embryo adoption, through the primary agency that's involved with it. There's no indication that there's any great demand for this. There's no indication that there'd be consent by the people who donated, by the people who created the embryos. I think it's perfectly reasonable that a couple who has excess embryos may not want to have a genetic son or genetic daughter out there that they don't know about. Not every couple who donates the embryos is going to consent to this.
And so we've got far more being discarded than we have being accepted.
Well, again, today you certainly have more being discarded, but the point is embryos can be used for a number of purposes, for research, for future family building among the original couple, and for donation to other couples. But neither use precludes the other.
The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. You can comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. Ross, let me just ask you, is the Daggett Castle bill sufficient? Is it enough for you? Are there any restrictions, or do you think it provides enough funding and ethical guidelines that it can provide the kind of research that you say we need to save lives?
Well, I think the Castle-Daggett bill is an excellent bill, and I hope it does pass, and it will be a tremendous boost in the fight against disease. What the funding actually is really depends not so much on this, but on what the overall funding is for the National Institutes of Health.
Really? So the overall funding matters more than this bill, or they both matter?
Well, no. The overall funding, in terms of this bill, governs eligibility for funding. What Castle-Daggett bill says is that embryonic stem cell research is eligible for federal funding. How much federal funding is available, again, depends on how much Congress funds the NIH each year.
And how much are we talking about? How much funding is going to stem cell research?
Well, the NIH budget overall each year is, you know, roughly about $29 billion, and that has doubled in recent years, frankly, thanks largely to the leadership of former Speaker Gingrich. A very small percentage of that budget goes to stem cell research, both adult and embryonic. I think, in the entire history of embryonic stem cell research, about $60 million has gone to embryonic stem cell research.
Now, Richard Dorflinger talks about money being needed for other things, for adult stem cell research, for juvenile diabetes and other things. Does stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, I should say, does it take from these other medical research needs by putting more money into embryonic stem cell research? Does that say, well, there's only a limited pool of money, and therefore we can't do research into other ways to cure diseases?
See, that's the beauty of the NIH, that research and funding decisions are based on the merits after peer review. So the decision of which research projects get funded will be based on which hold the greatest promise, which hold the greatest scientific merit. It will not be based on ideology, and that's why this bill is so important.
Ross, I want to thank you for taking the time to appear on the Inside Scoop. You're welcome to stay and listen to the remainder of the debate if you wish, or hang up. That's your choice. But thank you very much for coming here on the Inside
Scoop. Thanks for having me on.
And giving your views. Coming back, we have Richard Dorflinger. He's an opponent of stem cell research. We've been going back and forth here to hear both sides. And as always, you are part of the debate. You're welcome to call in at 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you could comment on the weblog. A number of you have done so during the show, and I'll be reading your comments. A couple of them are challenges to Richard Dorflinger, our next guest, right after these messages.
Time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who've got their tongues running 100 miles per hour but forgot to put their brains in gear. Today's goober is H. Lee Scott Jr., and boy, is he hot! H. Lee is honcho of the ever-sprawling Walmart empire, and he recently threw a public hissy fit at all of you workers, consumers, neighborhood groups, taxpayers, environmentalists, local businesses, public officials, women's advocates, local newspapers, and gosh, so many more who've had the audacity to criticize the world's largest corporation. Walmart never does anything that isn't calculated, so even the honcho's hissy fit was carefully scripted. It came as part of a two-day media event for about 50 journalists who flew to the corporate compound in Bentonville, Arkansas. This was the kickoff for yet another multi-million-dollar PR blitz to try buffing up Walmart's tarnished image. Indeed, its image is so tarnished that city after city, from New England to California, have been rejecting Walmart's attempts to bulldoze its way into their communities, specifically rejecting Walmart's low-wage, anti-worker, anti-neighborhood, predatory business practices. Rather than fix any of these practices, H. Lee lashed out at anyone who dares question how the $288 billion-a-year behemoth treats people and communities. He especially decried those of us who object to the $15,000-a-year poverty pay that workers average there. He wailed that poor Walmart, the world's largest retailer, has such a thin profit margin that it simply can't afford to pay middle-class wages. This is Jim Hightower saying, before you weep for Walmart, consider that it raked in more than $10 billion in declared profits last year, and that its competitors pay up to three times the Walmart wage and still make a nice profit. In fairness, though, Walmart's generous to some of its employees. H. Lee pockets $4.7 million a year.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. Today, the debate is over stem cell research. There's a bill that just passed the House of Representatives just yesterday to provide government funding for embryonic stem cell research. It's caused quite a fierce debate, and we've been hearing from two guests on either side of this. We now go to Richard Dorflinger. He is the Deputy Director of the Secretariat for Pro-Life Activities of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Welcome back, Mr. Dorflinger. Let me ask you this. You've heard my discussion with Ross Frommer. Let me ask, before I ask you other questions, if you have a comment on that.
Yeah, it was something I intended to respond to in the first segment and didn't get to, and then he repeated this claim two more times, so I'd say it's a pretty central point in the argument that we should get to. The myth of the 400,000 embryos.
Okay.
It was said a number of times now that these are in the freezer, the overwhelming majority are to be discarded, a very large percentage are going to be discarded, much larger percentage than are available for donating to other couples, and so on. And why don't we get some use out of this waste? The study from the Journal of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine that called Fertility and Sterility, this is the journal article that gave us the number of 400,000. but they broke it down. And they said, what is the percentage that is in the freezer slated for being discarded? What is that overwhelming percentage? The overwhelming percentage is 2%.
8,000 embryos out of 400,000.
And 3% slated for research. The vast majority, 87%, are only to be used for the couple's later reproductive efforts. Now, you may, you know, somebody may say, well, gee, maybe those people never will come back, and someday they will decide to discard them, or they'll abandon them and not come back and tell you what they want to do. But one thing that's very clear in the fertility profession is, even if that happened, those embryos would never be available for research. It's part of the informed consent requirements of the clinics. The only way you can get an embryo to use for research is if the parents explicitly say, use it for that and nothing else. The number available for research might be 11,000. It's been estimated that if all of those embryos were turned over to stem cell research, which is very unlikely, you might get, after all of the inefficiencies of the process of thawing and trying to obtain cell lines and so on, you might get something around 275 cell lines.
Okay, but Richard Doflinger, shouldn't we respect the parents' wishes here? I mean, if a donor, and according to the Get Counsel Bill, as I understand it, they only go through informed consent of donors. If a donor wants to use stem cells to provide the hope of cures for diseases, why shouldn't people be allowed to do that?
People are allowed to do that. The question is whether the taxpayer dollars of people who disagree with it should be forced from us to promote it. But the Castle to Jet bill works, there aren't any current embryos that are eligible for this research anyway, because it requires that, first of all, the embryos have been donated for research, and secondly, that before they were considered for research, the parents signed a separate consent saying that the only other thing they would have done is discard them. And that's certainly not the way the consent process works now in these clinics. To get this two-step process, you're going to have to start doing that anew in the clinic. So all of the embryos that are going to be killed for this research are going to be new embryos made from now on.
Let me go to the blog, if I could, because there are a number of people that have commented there. I have a comment from Dr. Ed from Kansas, and he writes to me, but I assume it goes to both of us. Mark, how is it different if I donate my spare kidney or a piece of my liver or bone marrow to someone in need, or my wife and I donate our spare fertilized ova that are not embryos yet to someone to regenerate nerve or islet cells or whatever? I see these as ethically the same. And there are a lot of people out there, Mr. Doflinger, that do see those as ethically the same. You do not.
Well, no, and if those people believe that an embryo is a kidney, then first of all, I won't want them to ever remove a kidney from me or operate on my kidney, but secondly, they are now free to pursue that and to pay for it. The question here is whether this is something that the federal government should force everybody to pay for.
Okay, but that happens all the time. I mean, I can give you innumerable examples where this government has spent money that I wouldn't want to see spent. Frankly, if I had my choice, I wouldn't spend a dime for Halliburton, and I'm a taxpayer and I'm a voter. But, you know, when the majority rules, we accept that, and that's apparently what happened in the House of Representatives yesterday.
The majority voted for it, but the president has a majority of his own.
That's true. He can veto it.
He's going to veto the bill.
I understand that.
That's part of the democratic process, too.
Absolutely, and it should work like that. That's my only point is that saying that, you know, why should those of us who disagree with it finance it, I guess I don't find that argument that strong, because those of us who disagree with policies lose in the democratic process all the time and are forced to fund things.
I guess it depends on who's going to win that debate. I'm just pointing out that, you know, if these people feel that somehow they are being prevented from acting on their conscience that tells them the embryo has the moral status of, you know, the bug under your shoe, from my point of view, unfortunately, but they are free to act on that conscience right now.
Let me read you another blog comment. This is from Mike, and he writes, when Edison found 2,000 ways not to create the light bulb before he found the carbon on paper solution. Mm-hmm. Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. He didn't know what he was going to find that morning. Mike writes, how do we know what possibilities exist if we're denied the opportunity to investigate what can be done with embryonic stem cells? Should little Johnny at All American High School have this Probably not, but to deny it to real researchers seems to be short-sighted. Mike writes, Richard Dorflinger, if you ignore your personal belief and the belief of some that life begins at conception, is there any other opposition you can give to embryonic stem cells?
Well, I think they're saying that, you know, you have to explore the possibilities. That actually is what the current position of the president allows. It allows the basic research to explore the abilities of these cells. And Mr. Frommer asked where I got my information. I got my information from the NIH, and they say there are lots more cell samples. They're in a separate registry called the cells that are not yet ready for shipping that could be taken out if we run out. So if what he wants is to explore what they can do, what's there now is ample for that, and there's $25 million a year going into it now. What the proponents want is to have, and without any basis in terms of the evidence that's emerged so far for why you need to do this, they want to vastly expand this and do a lot more destroying of embryos because they prefer to have a much wider array of cell lines to work with and so on, but their preference does not make a public mandate.
And Mike's question to you at the end is if you ignore, and I can understand you maybe don't want to ignore this, but if you ignore the belief of yourself and others that life begins at conception, is there any other opposition to embryonic stem cells? Can you answer that question, please?
I think there's also an argument to be made in terms of the marshalling of public resources for the greater good of patients, because I think that there are a great many other approaches, some of them involving adult stem cells, that are much closer to treating and curing people in our lifetimes that are being set aside because of this campaign.
Well, Ross Frommer says that...
That's not true. But
yeah, he said NIH makes all these decisions based on a scientific basis.
Well, actually, the NIH, and this is online, it's on the webpage of the NIH in the minutes of their stem cell research panel, they've been saying to each other they're very disappointed that what the peer review panels are coming out with, that most of the proposals for embryonic stem cell research are getting very low marks on the scientific merits, and they need to go back and talk to those people about the special circumstances here.
Okay, but this...
they need to give that a little higher grade. So the peer review process is working, and under that peer review process, most of these studies are getting low grades.
But this bill would simply provide that it's eligible. It would still allow the NIH to make decisions on a scientific basis. So, for example, even if the DeGette-Castle bill passed and became law, either by overriding Bush's veto or some other way, then if the National Institute of Health decided that these things were not scientifically a good idea, then they could still stop it that way, right?
They could, I suppose, if they really worked at it, ignore the fact that this would be taken as a mandate from Congress to give special priority to this. But, of course, the NIH folks politically also believe in this. They believe that it's great stuff to do down the road for a number of reasons. They don't agree with the president on the moral issue. And so I suspect they will leap up and promote it even more, and take Congress's act as their pretext.
Mr. Dorflinger, what is your solution to the extra embryos left over from in vitro fertilization?
Well, as I say, there aren't anywhere near. There are about 97% fewer extras that are a dilemma than Mr. Frommer thought there were. But I think a long-term solution has to lie in going back and figuring out how they get here in the first place. There's been a lot of irresponsible activity of the IVF clinics who just making many more embryos than they need and then trying to figure out what they can do with them. In other countries, there are regulations on how many you can make at once and how many you can put in a womb at once, so women don't end up with quintuplets accidentally and then get offered selective abortion and so on. But this is one of the most completely unregulated industries in the United States. I think in terms of, you know, the embryo adoption idea, that's one thing that could be explored. It's what we explore now if parents say they have children that they cannot raise.
But what if you have a donor who says, I don't want my embryo being used, raised as a child in another family. I want it to be used for research. Would you prohibit that by law?
Well, I would, if I could, I would prohibit the research that destroys the embryo. I wouldn't prohibit what the parent is doing, but I prohibit harmful experiments on the embryo, as some states in the United States have and as quite a few countries have.
And I guess my last question is this. My understanding of science is that there are millions of fertilized embryos that naturally are miscarried every year by American women and by women, indeed, worldwide. Is there a religious or other important distinction between natural miscarriage and the use of these embryos in stem cell research?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the facts are not really known because we don't know how many of those very early miscarriages, the vast majority of which would take place before this one-week-old stage we're talking about, we don't know how many of those were just basically failed conceptions. In other words, they never made an embryo. They made something else, or the process did not complete. But I think there are some that happens to, that there are serious genetic defects. There's probably the great contribution from our environmental pollution and from smoking, drinking, and everything else. But there is a distinction to be made between natural occurrences, natural miscarriage, and deliberately moving in and dissecting the living member of the species. And there's, I think, an extra moral element to it as well. If the government is moving in and saying, we're going to promote that, we're going to provide research grants to provide an incentive to have more of that done.
Richard Derflinger, I want to thank you for taking the time to be on the Inside Scoop. I appreciate both you and Ross Frommer for engaging in this very interesting debate that we expect to see in the future with when this bill wends its way through Congress. It may be George Bush's first veto. Thanks again, Richard Derflinger, for being on Inside Scoop. Tomorrow, we're going to go back to Afghanistan. The Hamid Karzai, the head of Afghanistan, was just in the country this week. And, of course, at the same time, a New York Times article came out about our mistreatment of Afghani prisoners. What is going on in Afghanistan? Here it is, 3-4 years almost after 9/11. What is going on, and what is the United States' role in it? That's the Inside Scoop tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Mark Levine signing off.